Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
I want to tell you my secret now. I see dead people.
Silent Green is people!
He's my sister and my daughter!
Rosebud.
What's in the box?
Hello, and welcome to another Slate Spoiler Special. I'm Forrest Wickman, Slate's culture editor, and today we are spoiling Black Klansman, the latest joint, I guess we should call it, from Spike Lee, based on the memoir of Ron Stallworth about his experience going undercover as a black man in the Ku Klux Klan. Joining me to spoil Black Klansman are Aisha Harris.
Hi.
Hey, Aisha.
Hello.
So Morris. I can no longer introduce you as a Slate staff writer because you are now, you have left us for the Gray Lady and you are now.
At the New York Times, yes.
But you are still as loyal as ever to the spoiler special.
I'm happy to be here.
That's what really matters. We're happy to have you back. Also joining me from the Bay Area is Ingu Kang, a Slate staff writer. Hey, Ingu.
Hey.
All right, so let's dive in. I have not talked to either of you at length about this movie, even though I have talked to either of you, both of you, about other things, and so I've been dying to talk about it. Let's start with what Dana usually calls a thumbnail reaction from each of you. I guess say both what your relationship is to Spike Lee's movies, which is maybe a big question, but, you know, are you a fan? And then what you thought of this movie and how it fits in with those. So Aisha, why don't you go first?
I have a, I wouldn't say it's a complicated relationship, but I do, you know, I'm not even going to say that. I am a Spike Lee fan. With caveats.
Yeah. And his movies are wildly uneven. I think even the biggest of fans of his, of which I would count myself one, would admit that his movies are wildly uneven.
Right. So I don't think it's like at all radical for me to say that. I think that that's actually probably a lot of his fans, if not most of his fans, are sort of, it really depends on which movie we're talking about, if we're going to really like ride for him or not.
Right.
And, it, you know, I think that in the last decade or so, he's been very hit or miss. The only thing I can think of that I would call like a true masterpiece that he's done, or even just like an excellent piece of film, like as of from beginning to end, unqualified, is When the Levees Broke.
Yeah.
And that movie came out, I want to say, in 2006.
Yeah, I would say
like right
almost exactly a decade ago.
Yeah, like right maybe, right after the Hurricane Katrina, which is, that is what the movie is about. It's like long documentary. And I think that that is a brilliant piece of work. His films recently, not so much.
The Sweet Blood of Jesus, I think we saw together. And God. That is like the one Spike Lee movie that I cannot really defend.
I can't defend that by any means. I actually think I watched that, like I watched a screener of it, if I remember correctly. And I wanted to turn it off. I really found Red Hook Summer to be very, very trying of my patience. It tried my patience very much. And Old Boy was unnecessary. I was one of the rare people who was pretty much, I actually appreciated Chirac. I think maybe Richard Brody of The New Yorker also appreciated it.
Best movie of the year, I believe he called
it. Yeah. I did not go that far, but I did think I was excited by it. It felt like he was excited again to be making films in the movie, even though it was wildly all over the place, like a lot of his films are, and I had a lot of huge problems with it. I was excited by how just interesting the sort of failure of it was.
Yeah.
So, but if I were going to put BlacKkKlansman, you know, between those two movies, I would say it's much better than Chirac. It's not on the level of When Levees Broke, but like When the Levees Broke is like, it's really hard to get that close, no matter what filmmaker you are, I think. So I really enjoy BlacKkKlansman, and I had some issues with it that I'm sure we'll get into, but overall, I thought it was really great, and I'm very excited to see him like back on top.
Yeah. How about you, Ingo?
I have to say, I don't think that I know his, sorry, I wouldn't consider myself someone who is super well-versed in his filmography. I would say that the most recent movie of his that I saw was Chirac, which, I mean, a mess, but an interesting mess, just like we talked about. And I would say that as far as a thumbs up, thumbs down goes, BlacKkKlansman, again, really interesting. And yet, I really don't know if I would recommend this movie to anyone.
So the one thing that you did tell me, Ingo, as sort of a preview of your review, is you said you thought this was a great movie that you could not recommend to anyone, which I think I gather that like you just found it much more disturbing and in that sense difficult to watch than I did, though of course there are definitely sequences that like any right thinking human would find extremely disturbing.
As soon as the movie was over, I texted a couple of my friends and said Hereditary was an easier watch than BlacKkKlansman. It felt to me like spending 2 hours like in 4chan or like the Donald subreddit. I knew what it was going for, but it was forcing us to spend so much time with these white supremacists. And I think sometimes the shock that he was going for, I definitely felt it. And then sometimes I was just like, ugh, why am I here? Like listening to these like reenactments of racism when I already know this is bad.
But you've got to hear both sides.
Come on, Ingo. I think I found it more entertaining than you did. I mean, there's that like Marx quote that history repeats itself versus tragedy and then is farce. And this feels like a farce about the Klan that takes place between the tragedies of like, you know, countless lynchings, especially after Birth of a Nation, which it talks about explicitly, and the events of Charlottesville last year. And in between, you get this kind of like blaxploitation flick where some horrible things happen and there's horrible behavior in it, but like the good guys win for now. And I found that very satisfying, even as there are some extremely disturbing sequences, which we will get to. But we should really dive into the plot. Although before we even get to the plot, we have to talk about the opening sequence of this movie, which has nothing to do with the plot and everything to do with like the history of the United States. So the first shot of this movie is the like famous dolly out shot from Gone with the Wind, where the camera like pans over all these wounded soldiers and then slowly dollies out and out and out until you see first like, you know, thousands of wounded soldiers and then the Confederate flag. Right. Which I was, when I saw that shot, I was remembering, Aisha, that that is what we chose as like the art for your piece about Gone with the Wind, because it's just the best single image that embodies the like lost cause mythology of that movie. So there's that shot. And then the first character in the movie is who, Aisha?
None other than Alec Baldwin playing, I don't think he has a name.
I have the name.
Oh, he does.
Because I think it's significant. The name is Dr. Kennebrew Beauregard, which is both just like kind of funny as like generic Southern white guy name. And I say this as somebody who is named Forrest, which I will loudly declare has nothing to do with Nathan Bedford Forrest. I was not named after any famous racists. But like Beauregard, you know, is the middle name of our current Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, who is named after, like, so PGT Beauregard was a famous Confederate general. And Jeff Sessions is named after Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, and PGT Beauregard. I mean, we should, I guess, technically, his grandfather was named after both of those guys, and he was named after his father, who was named after his grandfather.
It doesn't matter. It's all connected.
But, right. I mean, it's just like that name contains a lot of, like, signals right away, both the depth of history of in this country and, like, how it keeps being passed down.
Right. And so this character, Beauregard, played by Alec Baldwin, is planted directly in front of this. He's in a dark room, and it's like an old school slide, projector screen on the back of, like, so it's against his face and against the wall. I don't recall exactly what was being shown behind him, but he's basically giving this lecture about, you know, America being under attack, and he's obviously supposed to be Trump, but
in like the 1950s,
right, like
America was quote unquote great,
right? So Trump, or
he's railing against integration.
Essentially, he was every racist governor, lawmaker, whatever that existed in the 1950s. He's spewing a lot of the same hatred against integration. And of course, that translates, and this is what we see throughout the rest of the film, is these parallels between the 1950s, 60s, 70s racism and the racism we have currently with our president and our administration.
Right.
Don't forget YouTube.
Right. And YouTube. And then, and you know, later we get Klan members saying things like "Make America Great Again" and "America First," which was a common slogan of the Klan, even though that's not necessarily its origin. So that does make some sense, but it is not subtle.
I think the anachronisms of this movie is one of the things that really give it its power. There's a point at which Alec Baldwin refers to super predators in that 1950s video, and that's another example of how Spike Lee is really playing around with time to show you how we're sort of like back in these, in the period of like the 70s, which is actually like back to being like in the 30s or the 40s.
You're right. I mean, I guess the super predators thing is an anachronism, but like most of the things are like some of them might be a little forced, but they are totally things that like actual Klan members did say. And so I feel like the overall point is just like how little things change, which is a recurring theme of his movies. And I guess we should also say this is just like a really weird sequence where it changes constantly between, it starts as black and white, and then it's like, then it's red, white, and blue. Like these different tints come over. I found it to be like a mostly successful experiment, mostly just because it's kind of funny. Like he keeps messing up. Like you mentioned, you know, various racists from the 50s, but also just reminded me of like Bill O'Reilly, and we're doing it live.
Yes. Yeah.
It's also very reminiscent of like Alec Baldwin's character on 30 Rock, who has a whole episode about how he can't actually like perform this like straight video. And so there, basically, he ends up doing something like 900 takes for a 5-minute video. I don't know. It was like a really weird, maybe accidental callback. I also didn't really buy Alec Baldwin as a Southerner. He's like so obviously a New Yorker,
I didn't think we were supposed to, though. I think it was supposed to be very hammy and over the top, and like, you know, it's Alec Baldwin. Like, there's a reason he cast Alec Baldwin, and it wasn't for like any sort of realism in that way was because you see Alec Baldwin and then you think of Trump. And then you also think of, like...
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think about that. Baldwin as famous Trump impersonator.
Yeah. I mean, I think he was totally playing into that. So.
Yeah. That's a great point.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Yeah.
Okay, we should jump into the actual events of this movie. Ingo, why don't you take us into Colorado Springs in the 1970s and our protagonist.
So our protagonist is named Ron Stallworth. Ron Stallworth is a real person. He wrote a memoir, basically, of all of the things that happened in the movie. And he is played by John David Washington, who is Denzel Washington's son. So you can imagine sort of like this like pretty solid guy.
Right. I guess I wasn't super familiar with John David Washington previously because he hasn't done a lot of acting work. But I guess he was primarily a football player before. And like he looks at it like it. He's like pretty jacked.
Yeah. Now he's on HBO's Ballers, which somehow is on like its fourth or fifth season, I think.
it's because Elizabeth Warren watches it every week. They can't cancel it.
Clearly.
That is a true fact. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted, Ingo.
So he goes into the Colorado Springs Police Department and basically says, I want to be a cop. And there's a white interviewer and a black interviewer. And the black interviewer doesn't actually work for the police department. And we find this out very quickly because there has never been a black police officer in the Colorado Springs Police Department. And so his job is sort of to be the Jackie Robinson of this police department, and they ask him a bunch of really racialized questions, like if he's a womanizer or if he does drugs or if he likes to go to nightclubs. And then basically he's asked if a fellow cop called him the N-word, would he be able to sort of hold it in? And Ron has to think about this for a while and basically says, sure, I guess like if I had to. And so he ends up very quickly in the basement, I guess, of the police department where all the records are kept. And he's just sort of in this secretarial position where the other cops ask him for files and he takes it to them. And he realizes pretty quickly, I can do a lot more than this. And so he goes into his boss's office and says, I want to be undercover. And the boss basically laughs him out of the room.
Yeah, I mean, we should also say he very quickly, like, his answer to that one very tough question becomes relevant because he's very quickly faced with racism in the police department. I believe it's this guy named Officer Landers, I believe is his name in the sequence, who comes and calls him Officer Toad. But he, again, you know, has to sort of balance upholding his own dignity with... you know, not getting kicked out of his job. And then he eventually gets his first break, which is what, Aisha?
So his first break is Stokely Carmichael is coming to town to give a speech for the Black Student Alliance at whatever the school is there. I don't know which university.
I don't know
is.
If they ever specify what the university is, but it's definitely
college.
The Black Student Union has brought him. And yeah, at this point, he's known as Kwame Ture.
Yes. And so he is played by
Corey Hawkins. Dr. Dre from Straight Outta Compton.
Yes.
And also like the new Jack Bauer. Right?
Yes, on the 24 reboot or whatever. And also like an accomplished Broadway actor. Like,
yeah, he's great.
He's great. And so he's sent to go undercover and like find out if Kwame Ture, a.k.a. Stokely Carmichael, is going to be like inciting any riots or like it's basically what the FBI was doing at the time, yeah. which was infiltrating anything closely related to the Black Power movement, the Black Panther movement. And while he's waiting in line to do that, he meets Laura Harrier's character.
Patrice
Dumas. And she's the sort of... I think if not the head, she's like one of the organizers of
the president of the union.
Right. So she's the president of the union. And so his character is very much John David Washington's character, Ron Stallworth. He, and this is something I think we can probably get into maybe now or later. But so the whole a big conceit of this movie, jumping ahead a little bit, is, and it's in the trailer. Well, and this is obviously a spoiler special, so it doesn't matter. But so he convinces the KKK later on that he is a white man, and the KKK believes that he is. And so when he goes to talk to the woman, Patrice, in the line before he goes in to try and, like, get ahead of the line and not go, have to wait in line, she, like... something about him automatically seems off. It's he's just like, he clearly is not with anyone. He's by himself. He's kind of, you know, he's not, this is his first time going undercover. So he's like never done this before. And he also like doesn't know the lingo that, you know, the typical lingo of that time. And at one point, even before this scene happens, his bosses ask him, like, can you speak jive? And he's like, yeah, I can speak jive and I can speak, you know, proper English. Like, I'm bilingual in that way. Code switching, whatever. But what's interesting about John David Washington's choice, I'm just going to get into this, is that honestly, I was listening very closely throughout this entire movie and I could not tell the difference between his jive and his not jive voice.
Right.
And I don't know if that was a deliberate choice or what, because one could argue. So when he's talking to Patrice's character in the line, like, she's obviously wary of him and is like, I don't know if she asks him if he's a cop, but like, she seems.
Not then.
Okay, not then. She does later, or someone does later.
Yeah.
And, you know, his, the timbre of his voice. is not he speaks like,
I mean, the simplest, the like most sensitive way to say this is just that when he is later deliberately impersonating a white person, his voice sounds basically exactly the same,
right? And
it's totally different from like in Sorry to Bother You, when you have Lakeith Stanfield on the one hand and like David Cross's voice on the other hand. This is something you wrote about for the Times.
Right. There's also just this like sense of he pronounces white as white.
Yeah.
Which
it's like, I think it's a joke.
I think it's a joke, but then it's like, it's weird. Anyway.
There's this one line where he's like, with the right white man, we can do anything. Which is a very funny line about white privilege or whatever, but it's especially funny when he plays up the white.
Yeah, but then he also says it in times when I can't tell if he's supposed to be, like, if he's being sarcastic or not. So anyway.
And we don't know much about his background except for that, like, I think we learned that his parents were in the military or something.
So
it seems like he's maybe had a very sort of strict upbringing, which may partially explain the way he speaks. But at the same time, like, he has this big afro, so he doesn't seem like somebody who's like trying to, you know, pass or anything normally.
But then he also like clearly doesn't seem like he's down with the Black Power movement.
Yeah, and he seems like an in-between person.
Yeah, yeah. And so anyway, he's able to get into this.
Sorry, we should note actually one of the reasons why he's not really with the Black Power movement, or at least a version of it that Stokely Carmichael is pontificating about from the lectern, is that he is basically saying, Stokely Carmichael is basically saying, we need to go out and go kill white cops because a kind of race war in the future might be inevitable. And so he's saying, go arm yourselves, go buy a gun. And obviously, as a black cop, he's not really comfortable with that type of rhetoric, especially because he knows that there's a wire on him. So all of his white colleagues are listening to every single word.
Right. To be clear, I'm not sure that those are his exact words, that they should go out and kill white cops. But they are saying, go out and arm yourself. And like, if you have to, like, protect yourself.
Right. I think there's two lines that Kwame Ture says, we are being shot down by white racist cops during the speech, which is one of those moments where it's like, oh, it sounds like he could be talking about the present, but also it's totally something he probably did say then. And then at the end, he kind of whispers, I can't remember if it's him or Patrice, Ron Stallworth or Patrice, who asks Kwame Ture how to, like, prepare for the revolution, essentially. Like, is it really coming? And then he does say, like, yeah, you better stock up on arms or something.
Yeah, yeah. And so, but we should, getting into that whole, that scene, it's a very long scene. It goes on for quite a while and is pretty much uninterrupted. Like, Kwame Ture is talking the whole time. Obviously, there's, like, call and response. The audience is engaging. But, like, it's mostly him talking for, I don't know how long, like, probably 5 to 8 minutes-ish. And during that scene, Spike will occasionally cut to these close-ups of black faces, like ostensibly people in the audience. And sometimes you'll see one or two or three, and they're kind of...
they kind of look like the Bohemian Rhapsody. This is irrelevant, irreverent way to say it, because, like, I think this is a pretty amazing sequence.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the way that they're sort of presented, they're, like, presented just against a black... backdrop kind of floating in space, like beautifully lit. I mean, it's when Kwame Ture is talking about, like, black is beautiful, I think is what he's saying.
Yeah, and their afros are, like, impeccably just round, and they even blend into the black background. So it's, like, a very conscious choice that Spike is making there. Some would say on the nose, but it's Spike, and that's what he does. And I thought it was really powerful. I thought that whole scene was really... really played out well, and I thought that Corey Hawkins was really good in that. So, I mean, after that scene, he asks Patrice out, and she says, sure, like, I have to, like, finish up here, but I'll meet you at a bar nearby later. And so, I don't know, Forrest, you want to take it up from there?
Sure, yeah, I mean, okay, so we get two scenes in very stark contrast to each other. The first, I believe, is that we see Patrice, who is trying to, you know, just drive Kwame Ture home. They get pulled over. I don't know if, like, we're given a reason why they get pulled over. I think we're just to assume it's basically for driving while black, and or that they're targeted because
they were following Stokely. Them from the...
Right.
Because
they tell him to, like, get out of town before sunrise or something.
Yeah, and it's... as you might expect, a very tense and disturbing scene, including a part where this cop starts to grope Patrice, I guess.
And one of the other women.
Right.
There's two women. At least I remember seeing two women, and he begins to grope both of them. And that part's told in flashback. What happens is that we see her get picked up. We see them get picked up in the cop car. And then there might be something else in between. But then she meets him and meets Ron at the bar, and is like, I'm really sorry I'm late. But this is what happened.
Right,
and she
right.
explains via flashback, like, what happened and how he groped her. And then, weirdly, she's just told this story, and then it, like, just very awkwardly cuts to this musical dance number, which is really, really fun and great, and, like, the song is excellent, but she never really processes what happens to her. He's just like, she says, I was groped, and then he's like, let's go dance. And then they go dance. And I was like, what? Like, that really stood out to me. Like, I remember that because I was just like, this is a really jarring, you know.
It also really stood out to me.
Yeah. It was a weird cut. Like, it felt unfinished.
Right. That may be a case where Spike Lee does not, like, when it comes to gender stuff, he often steps in it more than with some other things.
Yeah.
So that this could be a case of that. And I think that did not jump out to as much to me as a man. And so maybe it also did not jump out as much to Spike Lee. It's like it's a really fun dance sequence. And it does, I mean, I guess it's probably a case of we're working on a sort of what's fact and what's fiction in this movie. Post right now, and I don't have it in hand yet, but I know that he really was asked, at least according to his memoir, Ron Stallworth really was asked to go to, like, a Stokely Carmichael speech, and that was, I believe, his first undercover assignment. But I would not be surprised if some of the other events are condensed, and if, like, his love interest wasn't pulled over, his future girlfriend wasn't pulled over on the same night and such. Okay, and now we have to get into the actual Black Klansman-ing. So, Ingu, why don't you talk about how he first goes undercover as a Klansman?
So, now that Colorado Springs has gotten rid of all of the Black Power elements, now they're going to go tackle the White Power elements. Basically, Ron is at his desk. He's not given really anything or much to do. Essentially, he says he wants to be transferred over to intelligence, away from records. And so he's just sort of sitting at his desk, twiddling his thumbs, goes through the newspaper, sees a classified ad, and it's for the KKK. And he decides, you know what, why not just, like, give them a call? So he calls them up, you know, like you do, and basically says, hi, I would like some reading materials, leaves a message, and basically they get back to him right away. And essentially they sort of, like, ask him a few questions about why he's interested in the Klan. He makes up a story about how his sister was sexually assaulted, I believe, by a Black man, among other things. And so he says, basically, I hate Black people, so I'm really interested in joining the KKK. Leaves his real name, which he does not realize until after he gets off the phone.
We should say that all the other officers are listening in and, like, what is he talking about? Because they're just hearing him say, like, I hate, you know, this ethnic group. I hate that ethnic group, using all of the worst slurs. And then they hear him use his real name and they make fun of him.
Yeah. And basically they're like, oh, you're a rookie. You have absolutely no idea what you're doing. But now we're going to go along with this, like, crazy case that you opened up on a whim. So they're sort of kind of stuck doing that. The problem, as you might have figured out by this point, is that Ron is Black. And so how are they going to go undercover? So they decide that Adam Driver, who plays one of the white cops, should go undercover. Adam Driver's character,
Flip Zimmerman
is Jewish, but
he's like passing right now.
Yes, he's passing, and also the KKK seems to hate Jews as much as they hate Black people, but in a way that, like, Ron is clearly sort of bothered by all of this very, like, outright hate. Flip does not seem to be. And so Flip will just sort of go do whatever he's told to do.
Yeah, Flip is, like, better than all of the other white cops, but still, like, refuses to give up his, like, privilege of being able to pass in order to really fully join this cause. We should just briefly also mention, we started talking about this briefly off mic, but that the other cop, who I think he's Adam Driver's partner at first.
Yeah, something along those lines.
Yeah, you might, if you've seen this film, you might be like, wait, was that Steve Buscemi? No, it's not Steve Buscemi. Is it Steve Buscemi? And it turns out it is his brother, Michael Buscemi.
I never had any doubt that he was Steve Buscemi, because who looks like Steve Buscemi?
I was confused the whole movie.
And then I was like, this is an interesting, like, I haven't seen this advertised. This is an interesting right. twist.
But
then
a small role for Steve Buscemi.
Well, but I also, like, didn't know anything about, you know, Alec Baldwin being in the beginning right. either. So I was like, oh, this is kind of fun. This is great casting. And then I Googled, and it's like, oh, wait, he has a brother named Michael who looks just like him.
Yeah.
And sounds like him, too.
And has not been in very many movies at all, which made me feel somewhat better about not understanding, like, not recognizing him or knowing what was going on.
Yeah, so the three of them are sort of tag teaming, like, working together throughout the movie. Mostly Ron and Flip, they are playing Ron Stallworth.
So should we talk about the elocution lesson?
Yeah. I mean, that's a huge part of it.
Well, I guess we started to talk about it a little before in terms of the code switching and talking jive versus.
Right. So essentially, Ron gives, he tries to give Flip lessons in how to speak the way that he was speaking on the phone, because he's like, look, if they meet me and I don't sound like you on the phone, our cover is going to be blown. Yet at the same time, Flip the whole time is very resistant. And going a little bit back to what you were saying, Ingu, earlier about his being able to pass, like they do at some point, I don't remember if it's earlier or later, but they do at some point have a conversation between the two of them where Ron is like, why aren't you angrier about this? Or like, why don't you care more about this? And Flip's like, I don't know. I never really thought about it. Like,
We should also say, I guess, like in his defense, that he at least claims that like he's not very religious and was never very religious.
Right.
And he's like aware. There's a reference to him maybe wearing a Star of David necklace at some point, which suggests some significance that he gives to his own Jewishness. But otherwise, it seems like it's not really a strong part of his identity, that he's not actively hiding it maybe so much.
Like, he talked about, I think, at one point growing up and being the only Jewish kid, but like he never felt like he was the only Jewish kid, which is like an obviously very interesting point to make in a movie about like who gets to be white and who gets to like assimilate and all that kind of thing.
Who gets to pass.
And who gets to pass. Right. And later on it comes up that like his being Jewish or the possibility that he's Jewish is a huge deal to one of the people he's trying to deceive, one of the white supremacists he's trying to deceive. And then later he says like, I kind of get it now. Like I'm angry now. But anyway, that's jumping ahead. But so essentially,
we're not jumping ahead that much, right?
Because true, not that much. And it's all kind of a through line anyway.
Yeah, I mean, essentially the next hour of the movie is a series of Klan meetings with, Ron Stallworth on the phone and mostly Adam Driver, who is, I think, very good in this movie, as he basically always is, going undercover in person and them sort of interrogating him and questioning whether he's legit and him proving it in various ways. We should also talk about the dynamics among the Klan, which are interesting and become significant.
As we had mentioned earlier, when Ron calls the KKK and leaves that message about wanting reading materials, he gets a call back right away. And so there's a guy named Walter, who is very eager to meet him. He wants to be the recruiter. He really wants to make it as easy as possible for Ron to join, because he knows that he needs to be out there smiling, making everyone feel comfortable, basically sort of treating it like a college club. And then there's this like very itchy sort of seeming guy named Felix. You know he's bad because all of his facial features are very pointy. And
he's also like sweaty in the way that like Southern racists, I guess he's, you know, he's from Colorado in this movie, but in the way that like Southern racists always are in movies, you can always tell a Southern racist by their sweatiness. He's played by, I didn't know this until after, this guy named, I guess it's probably pronounced Jasper Pekonen, who is Finnish. And I have to say, it was very convincing to the extent that I did not, despite the fact that he's Finnish, realize that he was like anything other than a white Southerner.
And then there's sort of this like very fat guy who seems to know like five words. He's like evil Hodor.
He's played by the dum-dum.
Yes, he is played by Paul Walter Hauser. I don't think I ever saw him close his mouth more than like three times through the whole movie.
He's the same guy from I, Tanya.
Playing and giving a very similar performance, although an even more exaggerated version of the like pathetic idiot.
Yeah.
So you sort of have this guy who wants to recruit, very happy-go-lucky. You have the guy who is very suspicious of Adam Driver's character. Rightly so, but who's kind of like this unhinged psychopath who you know is going to, who is basically a ticking time bomb. And then you just have this like lunk-headed dunce who's there to be comic relief.
And this might be like 100% true to, you know, three specific individuals, but I think it's also meant to stand in for the way that the like racial and class dynamics often have played out in American history, which is that like the poorest whites are the ones who cling most violently to their own privilege over black people because it's like the only thing that can make them feel superior.
Right.
And I feel like Felix lived in a pretty nice house.
Yeah, that, I mean, he may just be like kind of loose. I definitely get that sense from Ivanhoe, who just the like really dumb one, because he clearly does not have anything going on in his life to be proud of besides his own sense that he is inherently superior to anybody who is not, you know, an Aryan male.
I also love one of the things that's very funny about this movie is that there's this like very persnickety process with membership. And a big part of the movie is waiting for that KKK membership card to come in through the mail. But there's like a very specific line about how the hoods and robes are extra and are not covered by your membership fee.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a great, like, great comedy in the kind of banality of evil and the bureaucracy of evil here, which also brings us to, I think, the last main character who we haven't really talked about, who is David Duke.
Himself. Well, not himself.
But not himself. Play, I'm sure he would gladly play himself. Although I actually, Ron Stallworth has been giving interviews saying that David Duke like hates this movie because he's made to look like an idiot.
Well, he hasn't even seen it yet. Apparently, David Duke like talked to him and was like, based on the trailers, he's like, they make me look really dumb. And Ron Stallworth has been like, well, it's kind of true to the way he was.
Love that Ron Stallworth, who's been like giving, as far as I can tell, making all of his press appearances in like Beto O'Rourke t-shirts supporting that Democratic candidate. David Duke is played by Topher Grace. And I don't know, Aisha, do you want to describe David Duke's role in this movie a little bit?
So David Duke doesn't come in until a little bit later, but when he finally gets him on the phone, when Ron finally gets him on the phone, it's it is to call him to ask about his card, right? Because I think it's when he's like, I haven't received my card yet. And David Duke's like, well, I'll make sure that's in the mail right away. You know, that
sort of thing. Well, I think interesting detail is that he calls the national headquarters. And basically, it turns out that it's just basically David Duke in this one office alone.
Right.
So even though they have these like really grand pretensions, it's literally just David Duke picking up the phone as soon as they call. Is like, there's no secretary, it's just a direct line.
Yeah. And so David Duke is coming to Colorado Springs soon, and so the city's kind of getting prepared for that. You have the Patrice and her group trying to like prepare for protests when David Duke rolls through and all the Klansmen are out. And then you also have the Klansmen obviously like preparing for him to come. And I was a little confused. Like, was someone trying to kill David Duke?
Yes, there were death threats against him. But one of the reasons why he was coming through Colorado Springs is because he has political aspirations.
That's right. And yes. There's that one line that was the one like on the nose line.
It's
that
the
clunkiest
line.
Where, you know, I think it's Ron is talking to one of the other officers and about like the racism and everything. And actually because there's another officer who's like sort of not in the mix. He's not the chief, but he's kind of like one of the higher ups. And he's like one of Ron's biggest supporters. And he's the one who's like telling Ron, like, this is like bigger than you think it is. Like, this is not like a game. Like, you should be worried. And so he says, like, you know, David Duke even like might want to run for president. And then the line is, I'm paraphrasing, but I did write this in quotes in the dark in my screening. America would never elect someone like David Duke. And it's like,
ah. And then there's And then there's another line where I think it's around that time where someone says we need a man in public office to make America great again.
Yeah. So there's obviously so many.
Which again, like, make America great again was, used previously by Reagan and like might have been used in this context, but was not like a common phrase among, it's not prominently associated with the Klan.
We should also note that the Klan, while Flip is trying to be sort of initiated and prove that he is loyal, they're also planning to bomb the protesters who are coming out against the Klan. So Patrice and all of the other Black Power activists, they are planning to bomb them. And this is another interesting thing that happens is that the person who is going to actually set off the bomb is the crazy guy or like the cagey guy's wife. I forget the cagey guy's name. Not Ivanhoe and not the other guy.
Felix.
Yeah. And so
her name is Connie.
Yes, Connie. And Connie's this sort of like she's a bigger woman while like Felix is skinnier. Like there's all these like very cartoonish depictions, I think, that are being made of her not so subtly. She's like super eager to do everything for the cause. He like is very abusive towards her, but she's always willing to do whatever he wants and is like, yeah, we're gonna go kill those N-words. And there's an interesting scene where they're laying in bed and she talks about how like this is everything we've dreamed. Like once this happens, it's gonna be like we've been talking about this for years and now we're finally doing it. And It reminded me in many ways of this the white woman, aka Allison Williams' character in Get Out, where we're seeing this depiction of the white woman as being like sort of, if not the cause of all of this, but she's like the driving force of the racism, the embodiment of everything evil about the things that happen to Black people and the way that they and also just complicit in every way. Like complicit, I think, is the big word for her.
Yes.
And I think it's another case where, like, you know, before we were talking about how the race and class dynamics break down in this. And in this case, I think there's a little bit of a sense that because she is so like oppressed in the home by virtue of being a woman, we see her husband, Felix, kind of boss her around in the middle of their Klan meeting, which is, of course, all men. And she can't, like, really participate in that. So she sees this as, like, her opportunity to, like, really become somebody, even though she's a woman. So she's, like, a very cartoonish character. And yet, like, I will give Spike Lee credit for, like, complicating her character at least a little bit in a way that, like, sympathetic is not the right word, but you can at least understand part of where she is coming from.
Yeah, for sure. When I say cartoonish, I don't mean that necessarily in a... Well, I mean, it's not flattering, but, like, it's done in a cartoonish way in part because... I think in a way he's showing just how sort of ridiculous it is for someone. Like, you can understand it, but you can also be like, you're being ridiculous by being complicit in this way and being so eager to prop up the white man while also bringing yourself down.
Yeah.
And she plays kind of a big role later. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, so I think this basically sets up our two climactic sequences, which we've given the premise for each of them. I mean, I think it is not lost on Spike Lee that it is a sort of Charlottesville-esque dynamic when there are essentially like protests and counter protests or rallies and counter rallies. It's a little bit of a chicken and egg thing for me. I don't remember whether the Black Student Union initially invited an activist who in this case is named Mr. Turner or Jerome Turner, I think they call him, notably played by Harry Belafonte, or whether that happened first and then the Klan planted at the same time or vice versa. But regardless, these events are happening at the same time. There have been threats of violence on many sides, as our president would say.
I thought the initiation was happening at the same time.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, yeah. So the initiation.
And so I don't know whether it's a coincidence or not.
Oh, okay.
So you have Harry Belafonte as quote unquote Mr. Turner giving this speech at the same time as you have this Klan initiation.
I thought the cross cutting with actually maybe like the most notable part. I mean, they're very interesting scenes in and of themselves, but you can definitely see how the white group, like the Klan initiation meeting, which is definitely like all male, it's sort of like purposefully so. I have these like sort of ridiculous garbs, and even though they claim to hate black people, they have black people serving them. I mean, that's sort of, that can go in either direction. But at the same time, in this initiation meeting, because there are these death threats against David Duke, Ron, the black Ron, the real Ron, has to be his bodyguard. And so you have this essentially like this black surveillance of like what these white supremacists are doing. And there's sort of this like half shame, half, what do you call it? Pride in this thing that they probably feel like they're getting away with.
Well, during that, you have Harry Belafonte, who I believe he's portraying a real person, because that story, I believe, is actually entirely true.
The story he tells is definitely true, and the photographs they show
right. So
are
he,
real.
He tells, and the photograph is probably one of the more infamous. If you've seen photos of lynchings from that era of like the 20s, 30s, the early 20th century, this is probably one of the ones you've definitely seen of like the man burning. And I mean, there are lots of photos of that, but it's
right. In this case, it's Jesse. It's the photos of Jesse Washington.
Right, right.
And yeah, there's like a group of like smiling men, women, and children.
Yeah,
you know.
And so essentially,
all white, obviously.
Yeah. So essentially, Harry Belafonte is recalling in great detail the how that all happened, like how he was accused of something and then there was no trial, or the trial happened very quickly. I can't remember which. And then
it happened very quickly. It was like a rape of a white woman, as an alleged rape of a white woman, as you might expect.
Right. And this is as the camera is like sort of slowly zooming in on Harry Belafonte as he's telling the story. It's cross-cut with the Klan's members after they've been initiated watching Birth of a Nation and hooting and hollering and like watching it as if they're watching a football game or something.
Right. Cheering on the Klan as if they're their team.
Yeah. And so this is when Spike, I think, gets like his most spikiest, where he's very much using, like, he's, for as long as he's been, you know, a prominent figure, he's railed against Birth of a Nation, rightfully so, and the power that it's had, and this is him cross-cutting Birth of a Nation with this real-life lynching that occurred in, and it's very, very powerful.
Significantly, I suspect that that specific lynching might have been chosen because it took place less than a year after the release of Birth of a Nation. I was looking this up. It took place in 1916. Birth of a Nation came out in 1915.
Right.
There was like a huge resurgence of lynchings right after Birth of a Nation came out because of Birth of a Nation. Like, Birth of a Nation resulted in the rebirth of the Klan. So it's like, it's, you might think like, oh, this is just like Spike Lee. Of course he's going to be interested in the movies, but like that, there's no way to tell the history of the Klan without talking about Birth of a Nation.
Right. And I think when you pair that with the opening shot of Gone with the Wind, he's clearly like, in the same way he did with Bamboozled, his movie 2000, which came out in 2000, and the last like few minutes of Bamboozled is just montages of various racist cartoons from the past of like Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland blackface, like all this stuff. He's using all of these very powerful images that for years have been like shaped the perception of what black people are, and turning it against it. I do think, you know, that he recognizes in a way, or maybe I'm just like reading into it, but I do think he recognizes that there's like no way he can really push against that. Like, it's hard to compete with over a century of those images and think that it's going to shape those things. But I think that it still works really, really well, and he uses that to his advantage.
I think it's also not just Birth of a Nation, because there are a couple of conversations. I think one among cops in the police department, and then one between Ron and Patrice, where they talk about the greater representation of Black people in on TV.
Yeah, Black exploitation.
There's like there's a discussion about Black exploitation and how Patrice is really against Superfly because the main character is a Black pimp and that's a stereotype. And there's a discussion about how Archie Bunker made racism uncool. And so you can sort of see, like, how much of a throwback the KKK is within, like, 1970s mainstream culture. And then there's this, like, complaint about how there's too many Black spokespeople on TV.
All right, OJ.
Yeah.
They specifically mentioned the, like, OJ ads that, you know, one might have seen recently in Made in America, that documentary.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's interesting that he's not just sort of rooting this in the film history. I think he's talking about something very much about, like, sort of popular culture, like, now. I thought that was meaningful and sort of, like, drives home more the parallels to the present.
Okay, so after the initiation and after that whole sequence, they have, like, the reception afterwards. And so we have Ron undercover, and we also have Flip, aka Adam Driver's character, who's there as Ron. And this is something that, like, felt convoluted and didn't really make a lot of sense to me. But so there's one guy who's part of the Klan who, like, sees Flip pretending to be Ron and turns to Felix and is like, yo, I know that guy.
Yeah.
He put me away in jail like a few years ago. And
his name's not Ron.
His name's not Ron. Yeah. And first of all, the actor who played him, maybe I'm wrong, but he looked Latino and I was very confused. It's like, maybe he's not. Like, I could be totally off, but I was just like, you don't look. Whoa. At least you don't look like you would be accepted by this group.
I think he's maybe like Italian American. He's in a lot of Spike Lee movies.
Okay.
I had a similar feeling.
I thought it was kind of weird. I was like, you don't look like you're pure white Aryan, but whatever. Anyway, so this guy, like, recognized him and he tells Felix, like, that's a cop. And so basically his cover is blown. Oh, but not before Ron, or not before real Ron, Black Ron.
That's useful, actually, yeah.
Not before Black Ron pulls, like, a Sammy Davis Jr. on All in the Family and, like, asks to take a picture with David Duke. And David Duke's like, sure. And then he stands next to him and David Duke is, like, clearly trying not to touch him. And then as the flash goes off, he doesn't kiss him on the cheek like Sammy Davis does, but he, like, puts his arms around David Duke and the other white guy on the side of him. And he's like, what did you do? And, like, David Duke freaks out. So that happens.
I believe I should I'll quickly interject to say, I believe that is also real. And I believe that Ron Stallworth has that photo.
Yeah, I think you're right. So now that his cover is blown, I forget what happens. How does Felix, like, proceed?
So I think it's Black Ron who figures out that Felix gives a signal to his wife to go drop this bomb. And it turns out that the target is actually Patrice.
Right. Well, I think maybe originally she was going to bomb the student union meeting, but then there were a bunch of cops around. And so they were like, oh, well, we'll just get the leader of that group at her house. I believe that's the case. But anyway, she ends up driving to Patrice's house.
And Connie is, like, not good at putting bombs in strangers' homes, so there's sort of, like, a fumble.
She tries to put it in the mailbox and it doesn't fit in the mailbox.
And then she sees Patrice coming, and so she's like, oh! So then she decides to instead put it under Patrice's car, which is parked out front. But then Black Ron sees her and is like, what are you doing? And goes and attacks her. And then the cops come and these are cops who somehow don't know who the one Black cop is in the entire whatever. Anyway, in the city, come up and she starts, the wife starts yelling, get this black man off of me. Yeah. He's attacking me. And of course, you know,
she accuses him of rape.
Yes, yes. She accuses him of rape. And so they then it becomes like a very eerily reminiscent of like all the police videos we've ever seen where they're like, they take him away from her and like start to. I think they beat him in some way and they like handcuff him.
They like kick him on the ground. It's very Rodney King.
Yes, yes. And so then I can't remember if White Ron shows up after the car explodes.
Like the so car you have gets to explain how the car explodes because this is so the beating is this is you get like all the tones in this movie at once. The beating is quite disturbing because he's being beaten pretty badly. He's a cop. He's being beaten by fellow cops just because he's black. Basically, it's a case of mistaken identity. But the reason that they don't believe him is that he's black. And then simultaneously, Felix and Ivanhoe, the like two. Most like radical and dumbest Klan members show up. They like pull up next to the car. I guess it's Patrice's car that has the bomb on top of it or underneath it or whatever. And I think like one of them has the detonator and like the Klan member's wife is like, I think she's saying like, don't do it or something. And they're just like, whatever. And then they explode the bomb, which of course just means they like explode themselves. I can't remember, like, I think they live and they're just horribly burned. Maybe I think the movie like doesn't care that much about
but it's just
these
dumb
terrible
that they
people
did that when other cops are right that like it's just dumb anyway. So then White Ron or Flip rolls up and is like, he's a cop, like, what are you doing? And you know, so that's resolved. And then those guys, so, like, someone goes to jail. Or, like, it gets in trouble.
Right.
Connie goes to jail.
Right.
Connie goes to jail. The Klan members blew themselves up. And then for, I think what, how I interpreted the next part is that basically we get the, briefly, the, like, too good to be true ending. So they've caught, like, the good guys have won. Klan members are going to jail. There's even this moment where they, like, sit down with, Landers, the racist cop, and they like burn him and
they get him to confess.
They get him to confess on tape in like spectacular fashion.
About groping.
I mean, he also and there's a reference at some point to how he killed somebody. I can't remember whether
he killed a black boy.
Oh, that's right. I've totally forgot about that.
Right.
Yeah, that's like mentioned a few times where
and the police officers kind of close ranks around him. Most of the police officers consider themselves, you know, not racist, and yet, you know, they maintained their loyalties to this guy who killed a black kid. And you have a Lucky Man by Emerson, Lake and Palmer playing. So it's like everything's perfect. Everybody's kind of smiling and it's great. And then it's like the ending of Carrie is what it reminds me of. Above all, if you guys remember this, where everything is so perfect, like everything's like too sunny and too normal again. And then you get Ron Stallworth and Patrice like back at their apartment and they start to kind of this old dynamic between them of, can they really stay together despite the fact that Ron is a police officer and Patrice will not condone that? And then I think they just like look out towards the window.
Someone knocks
right
at the door and someone knocks at the door and then they open it. And then we get the signature dolly shot that every Spike Lee movie has.
Where
and
they're on the dolly as where they're the dolly on the, moves.
Yes, so they're on the dolly and it's them with their guns pointed and they're like kind of back to back, like, you know, Bonnie and Clyde or whatever. And they're...
Or like Blaxploitation heroes.
Or yes, like Blaxploitation heroes. And so their guns are drawn and they're moving down there, like slowly down the hallway on the dolly shot, just like, you know, any Blaxploitation movie or, you know, teamwork. And we see then that they're being drawn towards this burning cross on their lawn. And then it cuts to what I think a lot of people who, if they know anything about this movie, they've heard about this ending, which is a montage of actual footage of the Charlottesville protests last year. And I don't believe if I remember correctly, there's like no music underneath it. There could be, but I could be wrong. But
yeah,
it's mostly just you see, you know, all the white men in khakis and with their
The Jews will not replace us, Chan, and the tiki torches.
And then after a bunch of those sequences, we see very graphic footage of the car that plowed through the protesters and murdered Heather Heyer and injured many more. And apparently Spike got permission from Heather Heyer's mother, her family, to use it. He asked first, but he, and I think it's going to be one of those things that people will find polarizing. I thought it was used to great effect, and I think was kind of in a way necessary to sort of drive the point home at the end. And yeah, considering it's been less than a year, although when this movie comes out, it'll be just about a year. I think the riots were on the 11th and the 12th of last year, if I remember correctly, and this movie's coming out on the 10th. So having it be around the anniversary, and obviously this movie will, you know, will not always be seen right around the anniversary, but I think that it no matter what, it's a very chilling choice to make and will keep it from being forgotten, I think.
And there's also a little snippet that we see of real life David Duke, who is, I believe, endorsing Donald Trump in the clip.
Yeah,
I think it's, yeah, I mean, he was at, I believe he was in Charlottesville, and I think it's him talking about how, I believe he gives a statement about how, like, he can tell that Donald Trump is, like, supporting them and that they have a man in the White House.
Right.
Yeah, echoing that earlier clunky line in the movie.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it was really effective for me, too. It reminds me, it's the kind of thing that you might think would date a movie. And, like, sometimes Spike Lee's movies get kind of dated. But I think most of the time what happens is he puts in hyper-contemporary references to current news events and, like, whatever the, like, racial tragedy of the moment is. And, like, things don't really change. So yeah, in the opening credits of Malcolm X, he overlays, it's very similar to many sequences in this movie, he overlays a Malcolm X speech, I believe it's maybe about police brutality or something, over the Rodney King tape, which had happened, like, I don't know, within a year before that movie or something.
Yeah, very close.
Do the Right Thing contains a reference to Michael Stewart, the guy who was killed by police chokehold not long before that movie came out. And, like, 25 years later, Spike Lee edited the Eric Garner tape to the scene of Radio Raheem's killing. So it's like hyper contemporary, and yet it's, like, kind of evergreen. And in that sense, I think it both really works now, and I'm afraid it will still work very well in another 25 years or whatever.
I also think that the Charlottesville excerpts or footage was actually probably necessary, because as far as I can tell, no one in Black Klansmen actually dies. What we get a lot is sort of this black-white police cop duo outsmarting the Klan, and they almost seem like these, like, very jokey figures who only happen to have, like, a very, like, biting tongue or something like that. But I think that the Charlottesville footage was necessary to show the actual, like, true viciousness of, like, what they actually want to accomplish.
Yeah, I mean, another thing that we get again and again from Spike Lee at the endings of his movies is he really likes to leave people unsettled. Like, probably the most obvious example is, I think it's at the end of School Days that Lawrence Fishburne literally just, like, runs to the camera. It's like a Carrie type dream sequence, and he just yells at the camera, "Wake up!" like really, really loud while on a Spike Lee dolly shot.
Yeah. Funny enough, Do the Right Thing kind of ends on a happier note than a lot of his other movies. Not happier, but, like, less like tense, because it ends with him, like, going to Sal's and being like, "Are we good? We're good," and, like, pans out.
Right.
And it kind of returns, like, it's just another day now, which in itself is unsettling, but yeah, it's right, not quite as, like, it doesn't end with Radio Raheem dying. Like,
right,
there's a coda, and the coda is, like, a little more peaceful,
yeah,
in a way. Anyway.
I mean, I guess, like, even at the time, as you have written about Aisha, like, even with that peaceful coda, it was still enough to get, you know, white critics afraid that that movie was going to cause riots in the streets. So maybe he felt he had to temper it, or maybe somebody convinced him he had to temper it. All right, so we should wrap up. Do you guys want to talk about the David Duke call, or should we close? I don't have anything in particular to say about it.
It could just be worth pointing out that, like, afterwards, like, what Ron is going to do next is kind of up in the air. And also, like, it's clear that he feels that he has some unfinished business with what's his name. Actually,
we forgot something very crucial.
So the crucial point to make about David Duke is that even though Felix finds out that Ron Stallworth was being voiced by a black man and they were being set up, David Duke doesn't know this because they somehow didn't get the news to him because all this other stuff was happening. And so David Duke calls Ron Stallworth I think Ron calls him.
Yeah.
But he goads him and is like, you know, how do you know I'm not a black man, or something along those lines. And then I can't remember how it plays out, but eventually ends up
because David Duke starts talking about how he can tell the difference between a white man's voice and a black man's voice.
Right.
And he says I can't remember what he says exactly, but it's like something about R sounds maybe.
Yeah.
And then Ron Stallworth starts really leaning into, I guess, what David Duke would describe as blacker and blacker speech.
While his other coworkers are around him, like, giggling in the background.
Right. He's like covering the receiver.
Yeah, and then it just gets more and more ridiculous, and then eventually he reveals that he was a black man, and David Duke's like,
David Duke's head explodes.
Yeah,
We left out the thing I thought you were going to say that we also left out, maybe this will bring us back to the unsettled note, which I think is probably the note to end on, is that after they make all those arrests and stuff, that the Ron Stallworth's superiors come to him and say, we're like destroying all of this evidence.
Right.
And you get the kind of like end of Raiders of the Lost Ark type thing where they just like file it away and no one will know any of this happened for another few decades.
Yeah. It's like he doesn't get any of the glory of like what he did, which sucks.
Yeah. Well, hopefully he's getting a little bit of it now.
Clearly.
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to the Slate Spoiler Special podcast feed. And if you like the show, please rate and review it in the Apple Podcast Store or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have suggestions for movies or TV shows we should spoil, or if you have any other feedback you'd like to share, please send it to spoilers@slate.com. All right. Thanks, Aisha.
Thank you, Forrest.
Thanks, Ingo.
Thanks, everyone.